Blog Talk Radio.
Breakfast Club. Welcome, everyone. Time to party up. And we're going to get started here. Thanks, everybody, for showing up. Nice to see a lot of people in the chat room. Appreciate Radio Werewolf for having me on this evening. Shout out to Dion and the rest of the crew. And this is a new show. It's going to be a bit of an experiment. Like most of my work, for those of you familiar with my work, it's very experimental. What we're going to be doing tonight is basically introducing both myself and the format I have in mind for the show, and kind of give you an idea of my work, especially my work on the Pepper Plan, which you'll be learning about more. And we'll also be doing a lot of news analysis as far as how it relates to this model. And I'm hoping that you'll be able to use the model in your own work. So let's go ahead and get started. For those who don't know me, I'm Frederick C. Blackburn. I'm best known as being an NSA whistleblower, 9/11 truth advocate, and a former NC House candidate. I go by in the corporate world as Frederick C. Blackburn. In the blogosphere, I'm an avid blogger. I go by Blackbird. And I'm now living in the mountains of North Carolina, where I run a business called The Trading Post. And you'll be hearing a lot about The Trading Post model. And the Breakfast Club idea is basically taken from a 1980s movie. I don't know if you remember The Breakfast Club, but it's basically about a group of people who are very, very different, but are brought together in a common purpose. And in the truth movement, we have a problem with a lot of fractured groups, a lot of groups being, you know, you have the different camps. And it reminds me of when I was doing work designing the internet. I was an electrical computer engineer, networking engineer, and I had to bring in all these different companies and different technologies and get them to all work together. And the model we used was called the OSI 7-layer reference model. And I see a very similar type of situation now in the truth movement, where we have all these different factions and everybody's sort of seeing a small piece of the puzzle, but nobody, you know, has the answer. And that's one of the things I want to tell you right now is, I don't have the answers for you. That's not what this show is about. If I had the answers for you, I would gladly give them to you, but I don't have that. But what I do have is hopefully we can come together and look at this as a system analysis type project and break it down so that we can address these problems as they come up, and hopefully share resource and information so that we're not reinventing the wheel. Everybody knows the expression, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. If somebody's already done it, there's no sense in you wasting the, you know, resource and bandwidth of trying to figure out yourself. Just use the solution that's already working. And so looking at it that way, I guess the biggest picture we need to realize is going back to, I had an interview with a good friend of mine, Patricia Aiken, who has Sacred Cow Barbecue Show on Thursday night. And when she brought me on, she said, I want you to come up with one question. And the question was, you know, if you only had one chance, what would it be? And I thought about that a lot. And the answer I came up with was, whether you like it or not, you are at war right now. Every human being on this planet is at war. You are at war with an enemy that wants to see you either enslaved or dead. Now, the problem here is when people think of war, they still think of in terms of football teams and, you know, two lines on a scrimmage line battling it out for turf. And that's not how you fight wars anymore. What we're dealing with now is what's called fourth generational warfare and asymmetrical warfare. And basically it is a war for worldview. And everyone has to kind of understand that, you know, you are at war. And especially the one of the biggest targets right now is white European descent people, because as you learn more about who our enemy is, you realize that they see white European descent as being basically an abomination to their belief system and their end goal objectives. If you look at the World Zionist endgame agenda, there is no place in the world for traditional white European culture, and you're seeing that being destroyed. And so that is a thing that I'm a white guy from North Carolina. You know, I really didn't really want to be at war at this stage in my life, but that's where I find myself. And it's been quite the soul-searching experience for me to get to the point where I can sit there and identify an enemy and their objectives without going through emotional distress of being an anti-Semite or a hater or a Nazi, all the other things that I've been being ever since I basically had this awakening as to the fact that I am at war with an enemy that wants to see me either dead or enslaved. They do not want to see me free and happy and living out my pursuit of happiness. That is not on their agenda. And so basically each of us has to, you know, look at our own individual path of how we got to where we are and where we're going to go from here and how we're going to work together to address this global problem. And one of the big problems we have is our enemy likes to pit their enemies against each other. And so the second you step out and say, I think that white culture, European civilization is worth preserving, you're going to be called a racist and a hater, et cetera, by these people that have been programmed to see white Christian males as being the worst thing that has ever happened. And this is the kind of thing we're up against here. And if you're here, I'm sure every one of you has had a similar experience of your own awakening and how you got to the point where saying, yes, I'm under attack and my family is under attack. The people I love is under attack. My entire way of living is under attack. And I'm not really sure what to do with it because I feel like I'm swatting ghosts and fighting a shadow, which is basically what you're doing. You're fighting a shadow opponent. And so what we want to do here is go through, like I said, I'm just going to go through this show, just give you an idea of who I am for those of you who don't know me very well. Some of you have been walking with me for several years now. It's great to see some familiar faces in the chat room over there. And please, if you're listening, please join us in the chat room at radiowerewolf.com. And that's RadioWerewolf. Try that again. RadioWerewolf.com. Kind of a take on the werewolf there, but I have an open chat there. So, if you're here, you've all got similar experiences of how you got awakened. And also, you all have your comfort zones and where you are in the truth movement. You know, you may be awake to the fact that 9/11 is physically impossible. You may be aware of that the JFK assassination was physically impossible. You may be aware of the attack on the USS Liberty. The official story there is totally bogus of what really happened there. The list goes on and on at different levels. So what we want to do is come up with a model so that as people come on board with the truth movement, we can bring them in and let them wake up at their own rate of speed. You don't want to attack the newbies. One of the things I always say is be nice to newbies. We're all newbies here. And as you become more and more awake and sharing information, slowly you're going to start getting over your own cognitive dissonance. And so that's basically what I want to do with this show is, give you the tools to not only continue to increase your own awareness and give you good resources of people that I've come to know and trust that I think do really, really good work in the truth movement, to maybe give you a heads up on some people that you might want to take what they say with a grain of salt, and, other people that, I think has pretty much proven that they're controlled opposition and things like that, and you kind of need them more as, risk analysis more than somebody to believe what they're saying. So with me, I'm a retired U.S. Navy, U.S. Air Force, World War II vet. My father, once Pearl Harbor happened, did like most of the people in my family, all my uncles and my father all immediately, lied about their age. Half of them were underage when they joined up and went and fought because that was the thing they were supposed to do. I went to high school and college here in North Carolina, and I was graduated with honors. I was an Eagle Scout. I attended Philmont Scout Ranch out in New Mexico. I went into computer networking and telecommunications. I worked for companies like Research Triangle Institute and Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. I went to work for IBM. I worked for NetEdge Systems. I worked for Xylan in Europe. I was in Hoofddorp, Holland, or the Netherlands. I came back, went back to work for IBM. Then when they did away with the network hardware division, we formed a company called the Network Bootcamp Company. And this was a new way of what we call intense training, because basically we were bringing people in from all over the world, and we had 3 weeks to train them completely on how these new networking technologies and converged technologies were working. And basically that was the early days of the internet. And also we were doing what was called convergence networking, where for the first time we were taking the telephone networks and the data networks and combining them into one network. And so that was what I was doing when I was recruited by a company called Global Knowledge to develop a series of classes on the new technology of what was called voice over IP. And this was the basics of third and fourth generation networking. And I was basically brought in to develop the classes. And then those classes were sold to not only the telecommunications companies, but also the ICA, the NSA, Also, the military contractors, military intelligence. I did a lot of work with naval intelligence, Air Force intelligence, et cetera, because everybody was trying to develop these new technologies. And it was at that point where I started seeing that something was wrong. I was brought in the 90s, late 90s, to develop these classes for global knowledge. And we'll talk about that a little bit more of how what happened at the NSA. But going back to my personal history, in the 80s, in North Carolina, one of the things you did was, you know, you went to school, you went to college, you went to Boy Scouts, and then when you got out of college, you became a Freemason. And so I was a 32-degree Freemason, York Rite, Royal Arch Mason, Lodge Officer for William G. Hill Lodge in Raleigh, North Carolina, and this was around the 90s. And it was at that time that I really understood that, you know, while Freemasonry was a really interesting system, it was a flawed system, and basically it was antithetical to the Constitutional Republic. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, throughout history of the United States, you've always seen this play of Freemasonry being kind of at odds with the idea of the Constitutional Republic. And so I left the Freemasons at that point. I was also heavily involved with politics. I was the county chair for the Libertarian Party. I was on the executive committee of the North Carolina Libertarian Party. I was a national convention delegate for the Liberty Party. And then I ran for North Carolina House in 2000 and 2002. I became a 9/11 truth advocate on September 11th. When I saw the physically impossible collapse of the World Trade Center 7, I was sitting there watching it on TV like everybody else. And, you know, even though I was a computer engineer by trade, a networking engineer, all engineering students have to take a common core of physics. So you have this base foundation of engineering that goes across all the facets of engineering. And so when I saw WTC-7 collapse at free fall speed, I was like, that's a controlled demolition. It didn't get hit by a plane. There's something wrong here. And then when they started trying to sell me the story of the magic cell phone calls from the planes, I was sitting there going, if anybody in the world knows that those cell phone calls are physically impossible, it would be my students. And so one of the big red flags to me at my training with the NSA was nobody was concerned about the cell phone calls being physically impossible. And I'm sitting there going, you all know that that is physically impossible. You should be raising Cain about this. There's something afoot. So in 2002, I did an open letter basically entitled, "We Are All Palestinians Now," where I came out not only for 9/11 truth, but I touched the third rail by saying, anytime something happens, you always ask, who had the motive, who had the means, who had the opportunity? And of course, all roads led to Israel with their greater Israel agenda as outlined by Odin Yenin in his 1982 paper, Israel in the 1980s, Richard Perle with his paper, A Clean Break, new strategy for securing the realm, the Benjamin Netanyahu's book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win, and the infamous Project for a New American Century papers, especially the one on rebuilding America's defenses and how they needed a new Pearl Harbor to launch this greater Israel agenda, where they were going to take out seven countries in 5 years and basically just create a set of failed states of all the Middle Eastern countries, leaving Israel as the sole superpower and expanding Israel to the greater Israel, which if you look at the Israeli flag, you see the two blue bars. Those represent the two rivers, the Nile and Euphrates. The Zionists say that they are entitled to, and that's why it's on the Israeli battle flag. And so those two rivers is the greater Israel. And so they wanted to have greater Israel as only the superpower of the Middle East to fill the power vacuum after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So when I wrote this paper, this open letter, not only saying the NSA is doing illegal spying, but also saying 9/11 was a false flag and Israel is the most likely suspect, I was promptly blacklisted from the telecommunication industry and basically lost my house and my farm and my business. And I lived out of my car for a couple of years in a tent. And now I'm living up in the mountains of North Carolina where I run a small alternative currency barter and trade business called The Trading Post. So that's kind of my story of how this all came into being. I had no problem with Jewish people at all. Matter of fact, my best friend in college was a Jewish guy. When I worked at Research Triangle Institute, it was nothing but Jewish high management. Everybody in management there was Jewish. And I got along fine with all of them. But you have to understand that Judaism, by axiomatic definition, is a master-slave system. Always has been, always will be. And so when you're trying to be friends with these Jewish people, everything's fine until you criticize Israel or question anything. And then suddenly a different dynamic happens. And the second I started questioning 9/11 and saying Israel was the most likely suspect, I was immediately tagged as being a hater, a Nazi, a white supremacist, et cetera, by these people that I used to adore and love. And so I just lost all my Jewish friends over this was responsible. So that really led me to question the eternal Jewish problem. And that is, can the Jewish people ever truly be nationalist in any country they live in, or are they always going to be loyal to the tribe? And as I keep going through this, the next big thing, of course, was overcoming my cognitive dissonance over being an anti-Semite, because the second you say anything critical of Israel, they call you an anti-Semite. And at first, that would kill me. I would just be, you know, crushed when somebody would play the anti-Semite card. And then they would say, oh, yeah, I bet you deny the Holocaust, too. And so I said, well, maybe I should look back at the Holocaust, because up until that point, I always thought that World War II was the good war. You know, World War I was the great war. World War II was the good war, because we had all that, because, you know, they were terrorizing the world. And so having to go through all of that rethinking, so I sat there and watched everything that Denier Bud, I don't know if you're familiar with Denier Bud's works, wonderful work, but every documentary that Denier Bud put out, I sat and watched over like a two-week period and had to go through that whole cognitive dissonance of, yes, the Holocaust is just as fabricated as the 9/11 truth story is, or the 9/11 official story. So you start just seeing this pattern of deception after deception after deception throughout history, and you start to realize that these people have an agenda, and I am on the losing end of that agenda. They are trying to set up a master-slave system whereby people like me have no place in the world order. They want Soviet client states ruled by the greater Israel. And so you start going through the history and you start learning about the Federal Reserve and what a racket it is and how we have been enslaved by this monetary system that defines money as debt. And the second the money is printed and loaned, it's a loser's game, because there's always going to be more debt than money available in the system to pay off that debt. And so the 1913 coup d'etat of the Federal Reserve was a death knell to the dream of this great republic, which had in the original Constitution that the government was supposed to issue the money to get away from that British system of the City of London, which had been running this, you know, debt slavery scam in England ever since they were allowed back in England. So that was kind of my thinking. So I'm sitting here going, now what do we do? So we look at how they're operating, and we have to acknowledge that they have the main pillars of power. They have occupied all the European countries with the media, the banking, and academia, and the governments. So how are we, the people of the world, going to fight this? And so I started, you know, looking at this from a system analysis view, and that's when I started learning about men like Robert J. Ammon, who was one of the main game theorists in Israel. And basically what he did was take John Nash's game theory models on non-cooperative game theory. And when you say non-cooperative game theory, that's basically saying how to make somebody do something they don't want to do. And so if you look at John Nash's non-cooperative game theory, Robert J. Ammon basically took that and put a Talmud overlay on it. And that is the game theory model that we're up against, where they are setting us up to force us along this path. And the main tools that are being used against us are picking out the leaders. And if that leader cannot be bullied, cannot be bribed, cannot be blackmailed, cannot be banished, you know, through some scandal or whatever, then they have to be buried. And you look at the intelligence agency of the Israelis, and it's called the Mossad, and they are known for their assassination programs of taking out world leaders. And so you kind of go back through the post-World War II history. And not only did we have the Nuremberg sham trials where the entire leadership of Germany was, but we had this thing called Operation Gladio, where basically every person who would not get on board with the quote-unquote New World Order in all those NATO countries was taken out and assassinated. They were either suicided or out-and-out assassinated, and it was usually, you know, blamed on somebody else. That's one of the hallmarks, this enemy of ours, is they always want to frame someone else for their crimes, to demonize their enemy. And so we look at our leadership and realize that in the United States, for example, there is a woman named Cynthia McKinney who came right out and said that if you do not a loyalty oath to Israel, you will not hold office in the United States. And that was in office in North Carolina because, you know, I was supposed to be, you know, be pro-Israel, and I said Israel was concerned about North Carolina, and I'm concerned about the United States. And I don't think Israel should be getting all this aid. I don't like the way the Palestinians are being treated. Then I was put on the list, and there was a lot of money dumped in to the people that were running against me, and there were all these whisper campaigns, et cetera, going on because I had touched the third rail and did not swear fealty to Israel. And that's the reality of the situation. So how do we come up with the alternatives to fight this type of enemy that has all the old bases covered? And one of our biggest assets has been the internet, because when they were planning this, it's always been my working hypothesis that when all the planning for 9/11 and the greater Israel agenda really took place in the 80s, That's when they were setting up all the pieces. And one of the things that they did not count on was the power of the new technology of the internet, because it really hadn't come into its own. It was still limited to people like me who were in the industry using ARPANET and things like that, and it hadn't really gone public. So they had taken control of all the media. They had done away with what was called the fairness doctrine. We're used to a media, newspaper, a television station, radio station, if you said something that was not correct, your opposition had to be given equal time to rebuke what you're saying. They did away with that. And that was one of the death knells of free speech in the United States when fairness doctrine was removed. And that happened in the 90s. And so the internet has allowed us to come together not only as a people in the United States or people in North Carolina, but we can now in real time talk to people all over the world and say, did you see that? What did you see? What's the word on the street in New Zealand? What's the word on the street in Australia? What's going on in Germany? What's going on in Italy? What's going on in Spain? What's going on in the UK? What's going on in Scotland? And this is something they didn't count on, and they're kind of in a panic right now to put that genie back in the bottle. And I'm hoping that this will be their undoing, is that we are exponentially, people are waking up and realizing that the mainstream media is lying to us. All of these events that are happening are being staged. Mr. Michael Rivera over at What Really Happened has a running joke. He's an expert now to count how long it takes for one of their productions to be exposed as a hoax, because that's how quickly people in the blogosphere are tearing these things down, because we've got, you know, billions of eyes looking at this from every possible angle. You know, we have engineers, scientists, community leaders, et cetera, waking up daily saying, we've been lied to. This is not what should be happening. And people are getting braver and braver and braver every day. That's why they keep ramping this up and trying to, you know, slam us back down. But I'm hoping that, you know, the key will be the internet and our grassroots work. And that's one of the things about, you know, my work at the Pepper Plant is, how do we get out there away from the keyboards and into the community? Because so many of us, I think, you know, I felt like I was completely isolated in my family because nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. The second I would say something, people would want to beat me up for questioning, being so unpatriotic to think that my government would have anything to do with 9/11 or whatever, that, you know, Israel is always the victim, and how dare you question the Holocaust? You're an evil, bad person. And so you kind of just, you know, pulled away. But, you know, you had your support structures on the internet, but I'm finding more and more people at the local level are coming to me and saying, I want you to explain this to me, and, you know, tell me about this. And people, I will recommend things to people, and they'll actually go out and watch it or listen to it. And I'm finding the local newspapers are actually printing my editorials without changing them. Because early on, one of the things you would run into when I was trying to explain to people about what the NSA was doing, I would write a letter to the editor at the main paper, and if I edit them at all, they would always edit them to make me look like a complete lunatic. And so I finally figured out, you know, it's like I'm doing more harm than good to the truth movement by writing letters to the editor. I should just stay in the blogosphere and those are the people that are going to be receptive to what I have to say, not some editor who's, a lot of these so-called local newspapers aren't local anymore. They've been bought up by places like the New York Times. And so they know that they can't tell too much truth or they're going to lose their job. It's like the quote from Upton Sinclair, famous quote, "It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it." And that was what I ran into again and again and again, was you would try to talk to somebody and you could just look at them and say, they're not even trying to understand this, because they know if they went to print with what I just said, they would probably lose their job, and I'm not worth it to them. So, where we were, you know, with the newspapers, now I'm seeing that my stuff is getting printed. It's not being edited. I'm getting several people backing up what I say. And that's the beauty, is when you put something out on a comment board for a local paper and suddenly you get seven people not only agreeing with you, but taking it to the next level. And that's what I'm seeing happening all across the world right now, is, yeah, the big pillars, the mainstream media, you know, the six main corporations that own 98% of the media, yeah, they're still sticking with the storyline because they're paid to do that. But at the grassroots level, nobody's believing them anymore. They're making fun of them. Their fear tactics aren't working. One of the things about fear is you cannot maintain a fear state for very long. And I think that was the big thing with the original Odin Yenin plan, was they were going to take out 5 to 7 years, because they calculated they keep the 9/11 fear in our minds and keep everybody crippled for 5 years before it started breaking apart. Because of the internet, they weren't able to move as quickly as they plan to, the plan's falling behind schedule, and now it's all breaking apart around them. And I think they're in a panic. The mainstream media readership and listening audience is falling off exponentially. You see sites like this that are getting more viewers now than CNN. When you see the alternative media getting more viewership than CNN, that's a litmus test. Yeah, there's something changing there. So that's kind of where I think we are. And so how do we come together and organize all this? It's, you know, right now I think we have a situation where the time is right. People are eager for information. They are willing to listen to us, but they're also wanting solutions. And the problem is, how do we give solutions for something so big? Because this is a massive problem. And so it reminds me of when I was working at IBM, and IBM used a technology called Token Ring, and their operating system was called SNA. And suddenly the world went away from Token Ring to Ethernet. So I had to work with all these IBM engineers to say, you have to redo your hardware and your software because the world is moving away from the Token Ring. You didn't win. Ethernet won. Token Ring lost. And so I would work with the engineers, and we'd go through the specs, and we'd slowly migrate everything over to the new technology. And then I went with people and that people. And it was like working with Democrats and Republicans. It was like two totally different worldviews. You had the data guys over here using a technology called packet switch technology, and you had the voice guys over here using a thing called circuit switch technology, and both of them were saying, we're not changing. They were completely what we called intransigent. That's, you know, just refusing to make any changes. And so I saw my role as a convergence engineer to say, this is, you know, we've got to take these two systems and morph them into one for the benefit of everyone. And so with my model, what we want to do is, we've got people that are dug in and saying, our group has this worldview and this group over here has this worldview, And I'm like, okay, how do we come together and address these changes, but let you keep your model called the OSI 7-layer reference model? And what was funny is I could go into any class and say the phrase, please do not throw sausage pizza away. And half of the class would look at me like I had lobsters growing out of my head, saying that was the stupidest thing I've ever heard anybody say. What do you mean, please do not throw sausage pizza away? And the other half of the class would just laugh because they knew that please do not throw sausage pizza away was a mnemonic for the 7 layers of the OSI reference model. Basically, you have a physical layer and a data link layer and a network layer and a transport layer, et cetera, up to the application layer. And the beauty there was you could take the piece that you were working on, like the hardware guys, they could care less about software application. They were trying to get the signaling right for the physical hardware layer. And then you had the data link guys, and they would sit there and say, I'm trying to get from electrical impulse to something I can represent as zeros and ones. And then go up to the next layer. I'm going to take those zeros and ones, and I'm going to put them together into words. And then you just keep going up the model. So as we work to try to address all these problems, what we have to do is, like we say at the Trading Post, the first thing you do is stabilize the situation. Then you orient. Then you navigate. And part of that navigation is coming up with a rate of change that everybody's comfortable with. So when I work with somebody, you know, first thing we got to do is, you know, stabilize it. Are the wolves at the door? So I'll get calls here at the Trading Post where somebody will call me and say, somebody's in jail, or somebody's in the emergency room, or somebody is, you know, in a bad situation. And we say, you know, they're in a hole. We got to get them out of the hole. So first thing we can do is, you know, go and get them out of jail, find what's going on. And, you know, we orient and say, okay, what happened? How did you get going the wrong way? And then, you know, once we get, you know, a plan of, you know, let's go start getting you going in the right direction here, then we say we navigate. And you set up some goals, short-term, long-term goals. And so with, you know, my model, what we're doing is, you know, breaking it down is, you know, first, you know, your situation, are you living out of a tent like I was in a car? You know, do you have, you know, do you have a, we used to say, do you have a pot to pee in North Carolina? Because a lot of people, we've got, you know, millions of homeless in this country right now that, you know, do not have a pot to pee in, literally. And the second thing, do you have a place, a safe place to sleep? Do you have, you know, clean drinking water? Or, you know, are you dehydrated? Or you've got your fluid levels, you know? Do you have something to eat? Do you have money to buy something with? You know, do you have any kind of support structure? Are you faced with any kind of laws that, you know, are the wolves coming from you? Are we to expect that, you know, we're going to have armed police officers coming here because you're here? Are there warrants out for your arrest? Do you need somebody to go to court with you and act as your advocate? Or do you need somebody to go to social services with you and act as your advocate because you don't understand the forms that they're making fill out and you don't understand what the insurance companies are demanding on you? You know, all the way up to, you know, we do things like, I do a lot of elder care, and so we do elder care, and at one point, you know, that person's going to die, and so we help the people go in and divide up the assets so that, you know, we try to keep it so that the government or the debt collectors, et cetera, don't take everything the family has worked for generations. Family businesses. Because, you know, when the patriarch or the matriarch dies, there's a complete power shift, and we try to go in and work with those people and say, you know, we will work with you so that we can protect the assets of the family here. And so by breaking it down, I have my crew trained so that, you know, we can go out and, you know, help kids that are on the street get into a homeless shelter. Once we get them into a shelter, we can say, okay, let's get you into some kind of program and triage, you know, are you a lost cause, or, you know, do we have the resource to help you, or, you know, or you, do we need to hand you off to somebody else? And a lot of times these kids are so messed up that, you know, we don't have the resource to help them, but we can get them to people that do have the resource. A lot of times we can put them to work. And so this is the kind of model that we're working towards here with Trading Posts. The dream is to expand this model so that we can set up a network of trading posts and outposts that can share the resource like what we're doing here. And the beauty of going back to the OSI 7-layer reference model is nobody had to follow any of it. That was the beauty. Unlike all the early standards for electrical engineering where you had to follow this to the letter, to the T, or you were out of spec and you would be fined by the FCC, et cetera. Basically, the companies were free to say, well, we do it this way. This is our proprietary way of doing it. But in order to go out on this open source, we will change this part. And so it was this very flexible model, which drove a lot of the hardcore telco engineers crazy because they were just drilled in with that, you know, IEEE, AT&T, you know, precision, precision, precision. It's got to be, exact. And they were all saying, well, that's close enough. We'll fix it in the next release. You know, that was two totally different worldviews there. And it reminds me of the first time I picked up an AK-47 rifle. And I immediately put it down because I thought it was falling apart on me, that it was broken somehow because it moved. And I had never picked up a weapon before that moved on me because I had always handled these precisionally made, you know, rifles and shotguns and pistols, et cetera, that, you know, they did not move except for the parts that were supposed to move. But I picked up an AK-47 and it jiggled a little bit. And that was the beauty of the AK-47 was it was flexible. And so with the 7-layer OSI model, it was flexible. And that allowed everybody to come in and start doing the internet at their own pace. And they weren't mandated to or be forced by any agency to do this. And so with the Trading Post model, and every outpost is completely autonomous. You know, there is a loose structure and organization there of sharing resource and information, et cetera, but there's no central body above saying you're out of compliance, you're out of compliance, you're out of compliance. You know, everybody is free to pick and choose any of this that they want. My point is, it's out there. All my, for those of you who know me and worked with me over the years, you know, all my stuff is always shareware open source. You know, I don't charge for any of my work. You'll never hear me asking for a dollar. You know, I make my money doing other work. You know, my design work, that's all shareware. So as we develop this, and I hope, yeah, that my dream is that, you know, the people that are listening to me now, you'll take an interest in it. And if nothing else, just act as basically, I call it kind of like a critique, where as we give you the information and you see how it's working, I want you to be coming in during the show and saying, well, I looked at what you did and this is what I would have done differently. And so as you, everybody in the show, we're starting out together as newbies. Beginning of the show, I said, yeah, this is an orientation class for newbies. And what I want to do is then move the newbies up to what I call the freebies. And the freebies are the people that are basically helping me by looking at what we're doing here at these two trading posts and saying, well, you could do this, this, and that. And then as you move on up into the different layers, you hopefully will want to start saying, well, I want to try this in my community. And be, instead of engineering, we have what we call beta testing, where it's not quite ready for prime time, so you put it in a control group, you test it, bug up. With the Pepper plan, what we want to do is roll it out. We call it zeta testers. And the joke there is that things can blow up on you. And, you know, I always say I've learned 1,000 ways of what not to do. You know, I may not have the way of doing it, but I can definitely tell you what won't work. And so as we get into this, I want you to, you know, to become, you know, my zeta testers. It's like, you know, well, I tried it and, you know, this worked, but that didn't work. And the dream is that we will start building a grassroots think tank resource center similar to what we did with the internet with what we called white papers and requests for comments or RFCs. And in the Pepper Plan model, we have what's called RFKs, requests for knowledge. And this gets back into the, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. I want to have this set up so that we have a knowledge base of people that have gone before and they know what won't work and will work. And so they're coming in and saying, you know, they're trying to get something going in their community, maybe with setting up an organic farm or whatever. To get some food going to set up a soup kitchen or whatever, or just to feed their family, and they've never done any farming in their life. So, you know, setting them up with a mentor type thing to say, I'll be your go-to person if you need some help, if you need backup, and having that knowledge base there so that we can have this grassroots peer-to-peer system, because that's what we're working for. Instead of a centralized master-slave system, what we're trying to set up is a distributed, dynamic, peer-to-peer system. And the beauty there is that in a master-slave system, you use so much of your resource and so much of your bandwidth trying to hold this static system in place. And they, you know, the Zionists are always talking about they're going to set up a new world government and rule the world. You know, they're just going to, you know, beat you into submission. And we're seeing this with our police forces that are being trained in Israel right now. And suddenly our law enforcement is being trained to treat us like the Israelis are treating the Palestinians. And, you know, like I said in my 2002 open letter, we're all Palestinians now. And so instead of to protect and serve, it's comply or die. And so that's the model they're going for, is the static central, you know, tyranny, basically. And what I see, what we should be going for is a distributed, dynamic, peer-to-peer system. And if you, I know a lot of people, you know, they say, oh, the Constitution, it's a failed system, et cetera, et cetera. If you actually look at how the Articles of Confederation were set up and how the Constitution was set up, it was revolutionary in the sense that it was a distributed peer-to-peer model versus all the old master slave models of the old world. And I still say that model is sound. It's just that the Constitution has been corrupted by these people that are trying to superimpose a master slave on top of it. And they mainly did that by taking control of the economics and the media, et cetera. So we're not really getting to use the Constitution as it was designed. So, you know, if you go back and you look at the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution, and also look at how the Germans of the 1930s, how they approached this problem. And one of the things I was able to do when I was in corporate land was I got to work with people from all over the world. It was a wonderful experience. I got to travel to all these countries and work with all these people. And I had all these people come in and work with me and start to see the beauty of nationalism of these different cultures. And when I really started working with the German engineers, especially the ones, there was a company called BASF, and I spent a lot of work with BASF, and I got to work with their engineers, and they had such a beautiful way of approaching engineering. And once I got past my cognitive dissonance of those evil, evil Nazis and the Holocaust and blah, 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 all that stuff I'd been programmed with, and really saw what the National Socialists were trying to do to stop this flow of Zionism disguised as communism, because I always say, you know, communism was just Zionism in a red dress. You know, it's the same thing. It was a master-slave system where you had the Central Committee. Nobody owned anything. Everybody was slaves, but you called them workers. And I was like, you know, the workers of the world, unite and be slaves to your Zionist masters. And so you look at how the Germans approached this problem, and there was such a beauty in National Socialism because it was all about setting up this system whereby the individual and the system work together in harmony. And that was the original model to me of the United States. You have that, you know, our founding fathers warned against political parties because they saw that false dichotomy as working against everything that the Constitution stood for. We were supposed to be a unified people. We, the people, not falling into this false paradigm of left, right, conservative, liberal, whatever that means. We were all supposed to be working together for the greater good. And so what I'm trying to do is, you know, go back to these systems and what these people did before with setting up these, you know, peer-to-peer distributed models and how they made them work, where they failed. Really taking a look at, you know, what was really the model of, say, things like Boy Scouts and Hitler Youth and Girl Scouts before it got so corrupted and poisoned by the Zionists. You know, so like I said, my family was huge into scouting, multi-generational. I was a little scout. My father was where he was out. We were both in Order of the Arrow, which is an honor society. Went to several training camps, learning leadership skills, you know, independence, what to do in survival situations, et cetera. And that's things that our youth around the world is not getting now because everybody's terrified of letting their child be in scouting now because it's basically become NAMBLA. So one of the things about the Pepper Plan is I break it down into various stages of your life. So everybody's life journey, you know, I say, well, let's look at the first stage. Your first stage is your prenatal stage, yeah, that first 9 months. You know, what kind of situation was your mother in while she was pregnant with you? And then, you know, what kind of situation were you in that first 9 years of your life? That's, you know, up till 9 years old. And what are your needs at those various levels? And the beauty of this is what I'm talking about with the scalability so that this can work at the both the micro and the macro layer so that, you know, as we develop these community systems, we have training and work groups of, you know, our youth in their, you know, first stage, you know, up to 9 years old, and then from, you know, 9 years old to 18, and then from 18 to 27, from 27 to 35, you know, et cetera. You know, personally, right now, I'm, you know, in that stage of my life where I'm 53, so I'm getting ready to end one stage of my life and start another one. And so as we go through this, it's like, what are these basic needs at the micro individual level and at the system level, you know? Is my bathroom working? How do I handle sanitation for 100 people, 1,000 people, 10,000 people? You know, I have water to drink for today as an individual. As the system level, do we have enough water for 10 people, 100 people, 1,000 people? You know, how are we going to bring it in? Do we have food? Do we have shelter for these people? And so it's just the scalability is what I wanted, that flexibility, so that this model would scale to bring the needs of the individual and the needs of the system in together so that they become a harmonious group, which I think is the dream of what we're going for in this next stage versus the Zionist model of everybody being miserable slaves. I look, you know, especially as a white male, I look at the Zionist model and say, there's not a lot there for me. I can't really say that, you know, I really want that, and I don't want that for the people in my community. I don't want it for, you know, children. That is a miserable end game that they're shooting for, and it needs to stop. So how do we replace that end game with a better game? Like I said, as you know, we work through this. Everybody, you know, giving me feedback, starting it, you know, taking it and running with it. I know you. It is amazing to me the people I have met on this journey. There is so much intelligence and creativity out there, and compassion, and just. All these wonderful people out there around the world that I have come to know and love over the years. And I just know that you guys are going to, and women and men and children and older kids and elders and all of you are going to be able to figure these things out. Like I said, I don't have the answers. If I had them, I'd give them to you. But I think that y'all are going to be able to figure this out. We just need a little cohesion. And like I said, you know, stabilize, orient, navigate. You know, we just need to stabilize our current situation, do a good critical analysis of, gee, how bad is it where I live? And I'm kind of buffered up here in the mountains of North Carolina, you know, I can still go out unarmed at night. I can still drop a female friend of mine off at the mall and pick her up 2 hours later and not have to worry about her being raped and killed. A lot of places, that's not the case right now. It is horrific what is going on. It just breaks my heart when I hear these horror stories coming to me daily of what's happening in South Africa, what's happening in Europe, what's happening in New Zealand, what's happening in Australia, you know, what's happening, you know, in different parts of the United States. And one of the big things is, you know, we've got to be able to have a model where we can map out these hot zones and say, we need resource there. That's ridiculous. We cannot tolerate these people having to live under these conditions. A woman should store and go home without having to worry about she's going to be gang raped and killed. And that is not the case. And that is inexcusable. We should not tolerate that as a species. This is a warfare of terror by design. And if you look at the history, our enemy has been using the same model forever. And the idea of, you know, demoralizing a country by going in and raping all the women and children and murdering them to terrorize them and to, you know, just to break the will of that population, that's standard operating procedures for these monsters, and it needs to stop. We have got to stand up as strong, independent men and women and say, we will not tolerate this on this planet. And the problem is, you've got to have back. Fascism is horrible. Fascism is horrible. And that's the Pavlovian conditioning. You say fascist, and somebody says, oh, that's evil. And all fascism is, if you go back to the history of the Romans and then, you know, the Minoans before that, the fascism was just a symbol of one stick is easily broken. You take one stick and you can just break it in your hand. But if you have a bundle of sticks all aligned going the same way and bound together, then it is hard to break that. And that was the symbol of the fascist. You know, and also you have the axe in it saying that we're willing to enforce this. And so when people, you know, talk about fascism now, it's just such a skewed thing. It's kind of like when my friends around here start talking about sin. I say, I don't even know what you're talking about now. That those terms don't really mean anything to me because they've been so corrupted and so poisoned. So they don't really mean anything, but you know, that's the symbol. That's what we're working for, is a people united that can't be broken, and it's all about the will. You've got to have the will to stand against this and to work together and to stand together. And so think of it, you know, as those sticks that, yes, one individual standing out, you know, yeah, you're going to get crushed. I got the tribal treatment. They took me out. I lost everything. Yeah. I always tell people I got suckers punched and then I got bitch slapped. But I learned from it. It's like, okay, now I see what the game is. I fall back, regroup, reorient, and we try this again. So I've basically been in self-exile these years and going out around the world and slowly trying to work up a support base and, you know, like-minded individuals that also probably also lost your jobs, or, you know, life didn't turn out quite like you want it. But, that, you know, now it's a time to come together and start working together and move beyond the keyboard out outside the house, outside the home, you know, set up your perimeters and say, we are going to secure the perimeter here. And so one of the things about the trading post model is it's a lot of it is based on honeybee symbolism. A lot of you know who know me know I'm an avid beekeeper. My father, my grandfather, it's just been a family tradition that up in these mountains, we have a particular plant. It's a tree called a sourwood tree. We have poplar trees up in this area, and it's just what makes wonderful honey. And so much of the symbolism I use in the pepper plant is based around the dynamics of a honeybee hive. And one of the things about a honeybee is it has a 3-mile radius of bees. And that honeybee will go up to 3 miles away from that in a circumference to forage for food and water. And so as you set up your own outpost and trading post, you start looking at, okay, right now I'm in my personal space and I'm good. You know, you put your arms out and you do the circle and say, okay, this is my personal space. I don't have anybody trying to kill me right now. That's a good thing. And then you say, okay, my second boundary is my home or my shelter. It may be a tent. You're living out of your car, but you've got some external structure outside. And then it's like, okay, where's my property line? Is that a safe space? Is that, you know, can I reinforce that? You know, what's the worst case scenario of, you know, suddenly I have people attacking my home and my family and my loved ones? Do I have friends and neighbors I can call for the militia? And that Second Amendment is in that Constitution for a reason. Colonists were fighting the Revolutionary War. The enemy was using the same tactics. You pick out the leadership and you go get them in the middle of the night where they have no support around them. And so the idea of the Minutemen was key to that, because the second is, you know, the rioters were spotted, you sent runners out to all your neighbors who came running armed for bear so that you couldn't get taken in the middle of the night. And so it's so critical that we say, okay, this is my 3-mile radius around my trading post or my outpost. What is my, who are my allies, you know, and my neighbors and my family members in this 3-mile radius that, you know, I can call them and they can call me and we can work together if things hit the fan. And so that's what we want to work for. Instead of, you know, Minutemen, we want flash mobs, you know, so that we've got instantaneous alerts of, you know, this is happening right now. Of what's going on. And then, you know, just basically stand against these marauders and invaders that are coming in to, you know, carry out this terrorist agenda that, you know, so many of our brothers and sisters are being faced with. Like I said, especially, you know, if you have not researched what's going on in South Africa and Europe right now, and it just will break your heart to see what is happening in those areas. And it has not stopped. And we have got to come up with ways to make it stop. And so as we go through this, you know, working out how to stand against this and then just network together. One of the things that I model this network design on, not only the internet, where you have what we call local area networks and then wide area networks, where you know a trading post will serve, and you have so many trading posts in the county or a parish, but then, you know, to break it down into districts and councils of, you know, support and resource and scalability, so that we're working at a cooperative model. And a, you know, and that's, you know, another big thing is getting away from this non-cooperative model of, you know, people like Robert J. Almond, where it's, you know, forcing you to do things, is getting into a cooperative model, so that with cooperative models, not only are you not wasting all your resource and bandwidth of trying to hold a static system in place, but you also get the added benefits of what's called synergy. That was a term coined by a guy named Buckminster Fuller, where suddenly with cooperative systems, the system is bigger than the sum of its parts. You get this added benefit that you really can't, you know, put in a test tube. It's just, you get an added benefit there. And also the synergy, you start with the cooperative things just start happening, and that's called, you know, synchronicity. And so we get this added bonus of, you know, the effort we put forward into developing these systems that our enemy does not have. Our enemy, you know, has to hold things in with a, you know, clenched fist. And you think all these people doing these things in the Middle East are all mercenaries. They are working for money. And the second that money runs out, they are not going to be supporting that agenda anymore. And that's one of the things that, you know, they always have to have tons of money to be able to finance all these black ops around the world. And so we have to come up with ways to not only stabilize our own situation, but then start attacking their system. And the biggest way to do that is by starving them. I always talk about starve Boz, the beast of Zion, Boz. You start whittling it down, you know, piece by piece. You know, stop sending money to Israel. Stop, you know, any support of these systems. And you do that by, you know, informing people of what's going on. And start putting, you know, political force on this, and it can be done. That's the thing. We've got to understand that there are millions more of us than there are of them. We have just been fragmented and demoralized into what's called a learned helplessness state. And that is the biggest problem we have, is we lack the will to stand together. And we have got to learn how to start working together as a system without, you know, people are so put off now by quote unquote pointing anything because they're going to lose their individual identity, their individual freedom, And also because they're going to have to work for something that may not benefit them directly. And that is part of working for sacrifice. And, you know, scouts, you know, we were always taught about cheerful service. And it was amazing the things we would accomplish coming together and working on a project over a weekend, but you just had, a couple of dozen, you know, young men and women out there working, and you can accomplish great things. And so our enemy, you know, they are holding everything together with their money and their coercion, their blackmail, their bribery, et cetera. You know, we've got to come up with an independent system that is free from all of that and that willing to work together without, you know, feeling that you're, you know, giving up your identity or going for some cult or whatever. And that is why I designed this to be such an open source type system that it's basically a communication model where people are able to share resource and information without having to sign their name on a contract. You know, where instead of being a corporation, the Trading Post is set up as a cooperation. And it's, you know, the way I have mine set up here, it's all a profit sharing model with my crew. Other people may want to set it up as a mom and pop type business structure, et cetera. Yes, you know, that's the beauty of the scalability is, you know, it can go everywhere from just an individual in a great economy doing odd jobs, cleaning out gutters, mowing lawns, et cetera, you know, being paid cash up through a full corporate, but maintaining the integrity of a model versus how the enemy sets their businesses up. And so that's, you know, the dream of what I'm trying to accomplish here. And like I said, I've been working on this for several decades now, because I was kind of working on this before 9/11, but it took a totally different turn and a new sense of urgency after 9/11. And it's basically just a way of sharing information and resource to bring people together to focus on the problems and addressing those problems at all the different strata of society. Like I always say, you know, we're moving at the micro level up to the macro level. Okay. So anyway, so that's basically what I'm wanting to do this show as we go through it. So like I said, it's going to be a weekly show. We're going to be from 8 to 10 every Wednesday night. And again, you know, shout out to Dion for giving me this wonderful opportunity. I really appreciate it. And as we go through this, I want to tonight I didn't want to take any phone calls or anything because I just wanted to introduce myself, introduce the show, kind of give an idea of where I want the show to go. Next week, what we want to do is start taking phone calls and, you know, be more involved with the chat room, et cetera. Also, be setting up a website soon. I wanted to have that done before tonight's show, but we had a couple of situations here at the Trading Post that I had to deal with. It took priority. But I will be, you know, putting this stuff out on the webpage, and you'll be able to access the ticket. It is a hierarchical model. A lot of people, you know, especially people that have been trained or conditioned, I should say, in that democracy model, which is such a bogus thing. The United States is not a democracy. It was never set up as a democracy. Our founding fathers thought democracies were the worst form of government because it's basically mob rule, a tyranny, which is what communism is. But the Jews are always pushing democracy, democracy, democracy. all people may be created equal, but people are not equal. That is a myth. That is a fraudulent lie to say all people are equal. That is not true. Everybody has their own skill sets, data, ability sets, leadership potential, et cetera. And the trade and post model is a meritocratic hierarchical model. There are, it's like scouting where you have the different ranks and qualifications. The more qualified you are and the more experience points you have, as in, how much you have done, the more you have a more say in what's going on, both at your trading post, your outpost, and the system in general. And a lot of this will be as people come together and learn who each other are. I'm very excited that, people I have met all over that I'm hoping will come together here and all of y'all work together. One of the things in my writing, you'll see that I always talk about crews. And that was something when we were first working on the internet and the idea of websites and web browsers back in the 90s. I was designing a presentation and I was talking about how we would start developing these spaces, virtual communities that a person, that are going to be made up of all these individuals from various parts of the world coming together, but unlike a military unit or some crew where you're only allowed to be in one crew or, one platoon or whatever, and if you try to work outside of that group, you would be considered a traitor to the group. You had to have crew loyalty or platoon loyalty, and kind of getting into that, fraternity model where, you only have loyalty to one group. Well, I introduced the idea of crew with a K based on what you see in like Carnival down in Brazil or Mardi Gras in Louisiana, because for a lot of my mother's side of the family is all from Louisiana, and my father's side is from the mountain North Carolina. So one of the things you have during Mardi Gras is the people working on the floats and such, they are called crews with a K. And the beauty there is you can be in more than one crew. And during Mardi Gras, the crews put on all these wonderful parties. And part of the fun is being able to go from this party to this party to this party because you're all part of those crews. And so I introduced the term crew to describe these virtual communities that were going to be springing up with the advent of the internet, and that people would, would be part of this crew, but they'd also be part of this crew. And so as I've traveled around the world virtually, have a lot of friends from, say, Michael Rivera's What Really Happened crew, the World Truth crew. Now I'm part of the Radio Werewolf crew, the Dennis Fecho Inside the Eye Live crew. Gone out and listened to Mr. Fecho, who's an incredibly wise man, lots of good life experience, and he has definitely done his homework, and that is one of the best knowledgeable chat rooms on the internet for homework. Everybody shows up every week with lots of stuff to share, and it's a great experience, and just all these various crews. Also, my friend Patricia Aiken, who does the Sacred Cow Barbecue, that crew. So what we have is, also the Mamie's crew, a lot of great folks over at Mamie's that I have learned so much from over the years. And so, we're going to be developing these crews to share information. And the beauty is that, you know, you can be part of more than one system. And, for example, you know, physically, I've got two trading posts going physically that I'm setting up separate counties here. One in Fulton County and one in Pitt County here in North Carolina. And the dream is to have a trading post in every county in North Carolina within the next 5 years. That's my goal. But, you know, wanting to spread this out and have this model throughout the world, basically, you know, so that we have this network, because, like I said at the beginning of the show, you know, we are at war, whether or not we like it. We're at war with an enemy that wants to see us either dead or enslaved. And I find that unacceptable. And so as a species, basically, we have got to stand against this, or that's the fate we're looking at. And like I said, I've studied the Talmud, I've studied the Kabbalah, I've studied the Zohar, I've studied the sacred magic of Abramelin the Mage and all these wonderful, horrific Jewish supremacists. Don't say wonderful, well, horrific, wonderful, like then make drop your jaw and say, I can't believe anybody thinks like that. But just these horrific Jewish supremacist worldview manifestos that, you know, I see what is in store for us if we do not stand together against it. And it is not a pretty picture. And like I said, you know, one of the biggest things about the Talmud is kill the best Gentiles. And I just see that, you know, my number just keeps rising up in the charts. And so my goal is to try to do as much as I possibly can against them before my number comes up. And that's just the way they work. You know, they view the world, and if you go through and look at what Robert J. Ammon is trying to set up with his modeling and what the Talmud says, it's, you know, you're either in the book of life or you're in the book of death. And the idea of, you know, we talk about the Operation Gladio, et cetera, you know, they are not to figure out who is a threat, who to take out, and the leaders are the ones to go first. They did this in Russia, they did it in Turkey, they did it in the Ukraine. This is their model. You take out the leadership, and that leaves the crowd without leadership, and so they're more easily controlled. And then once the leadership's gone, they go in and figure out who is of use to them, and they have their little seven-layer model of, you know, people that can work as rewarded slaves, and you know, that was in the old system, it was called a house slave, somebody that you would trust in your home that you didn't have to worry about them killing you while you slept because they were rewarded up through, you know, and then you go on down to, you know, prison forced labor, you know, the chain gang model. And then if you don't match those criterion of either a rewarded slave, which is called one management, where, you know, the slave is rewarded for good service, down to theory X managed forced labor, where your reward is if you do a good job, you're not punished. And so you're, you know, that fear of punishment is what motivates you. So if you're not in that range, then they have no use for you. And these people killed, you know, 60 million Russians. I mean, and then you look at the Ukraine, how many they killed, and in Turkey, the Armenians, how many they killed. And if you don't think that could happen in the United States or Canada or New Zealand or Australia or Europe, you're in denial. You know, you have to look at, this is the same tribe. They've been doing this for thousands of years. This is how they operate. This is their worldview. They are totally intransigent. They are not to change their worldview. Like I said, Judaism has always been, will always be a master-slave system. And they're not going to change. And I don't see that we should tolerate that. We have got to come together and stand against that. So, like I said, in this model, you know, it's all about getting the model out there, and hopefully we're going to start getting some good, you know, dynamic energy going, and that will, people are attracted to success. When they see it working, they are going to be a lot more receptive to you saying, think about this, and you know, just giving them those little pieces. I call it spoon feeding or baby feeding, you know, baby steps. They may be awake to 9/11 was, you know, bogus, or that Iraq was based on lies and cooked intelligence, but they're not quite ready to talk about JFK. They're not quite ready to talk liberty. They're not quite ready to talk about the Federal Reserve. But if you can show them that you have a system and it is working, then they will be receptive to you. And like I said, then you just spoon feed them at the rate of change they can handle. Now, one of the biggest problems we're up against is the conditioning. And it will also in the show, what we're going to be talking about is all the psychological testing and experimentation, especially that was done in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Which we're basically being exposed to now. Things like Stanley Milgram's authority experiments, where, you know, if an authority figure says, you know, kill that person, you know, 50% of the people in the United States would do it. They would give a lethal, what they thought was a lethal dose of electrical shock to the test subject because some guy in a white coat said, I authorize this. Now these drum operators who are being told kill that family with that drone strike, we authorize it. And we've got all these young kids that are now just suicidal. If they haven't already committed suicidal, they're just completely broken right now because they realize what they did was so wrong, but they did it because an authority figure told them to do it. Same thing with snipers. Used to, you did North United States would not tolerate snipers in the military because they were considered assassins, and that has totally morphed into, you know, this glamorization of these snipers going out and assassinating all these people around the world just because their name showed up on some hit list generated by these Jewish supremacists via these quote-unquote intelligence agencies like the Mossad, MI6, and the CIA using intel, you know, brought together by the NSA and the Israeli groups. His mentor was Solomon Ash, who did the bit on group conformity. And so we'll be talking about, you know, how that group conformity works, where, you know, people won't step out of line if they think the group consensus says they're wrong. You know, that idea of staying with the group is very, very powerful in our psyches. And one of the things, you know, we'll learn is the, what I call the 1 of 20 rule, or the 5% rule, where if you take 20 people and put them in a room, one person is going to emerge to be the natural leader in that group. And if you, then you take that person and put them with 20 people from other groups, then one of those 20 is going to emerge as the natural leader. And so based on Solomon Ash's work, the idea is to pick out that 1 of 20 and kill them, and that leaves the other 19 looking for leadership, and that's how your authority figures can come in and say, yes, basically you're now but you're still part of this new group under this new leadership. And that was what we saw in the Soviet Union, is, you know, you kill off all the natural leaders and they would follow the Red Army and all those, you know, Politruks and commissars who were then the new authority figures, and they would you know, either comply or die. If you either complied or you got sent to the gulag, or they just shot you. And so that's the kind of research from Solomon Ash. Also, people like the guy who did this, I can't remember his name right offhand, but you know, the infamous Stanford Prison Experiment, where everything that was shown in that Stanford Prison Experiment, we saw at Gitmo, and still seeing at Gitmo and Abu Ghraib. It's how do you turn these nice young kids, you know, the best of the best, the best of the sprightest, and you turn them into these monster prison guards that will torture people because some authority figure authorized it. So we'll be studying all of these tactics and technologies so that we could be developing defenses against them. One of the biggest defenses is just knowledge of the games that are being played on them. You know, it's like a magician can deceive you if you don't know the trick. But once you understand how the trick is done, the illusion is shattered. That's why the, you know, the Jews always insist on controlling the narrative. They won't let any free speech happen that might contradict what they're trying to create as far as an illusion goes. And so once you can break that illusion, the spell is broken and they lose their power. But as long as the Jews are allowed to control the stage, then people will fall for the trick. So part of this is going to be training all of you with what I've learned, and hopefully you're going to be training me about things you've learned, you know, in this peer-to-peer exchange of information. And we create this knowledge base. And so as newbies come on board, then, you know, we've got our and I would love to get to the point of what we had in corporate land when I was doing what was called the IBM and networking boot camps, where basically you would condense a semester's worth of work or, you know, class into a 2 or 3 week class. And we called them boot camps, where basically I had to take these engineers and bring them up to speed so they could get their certifications and go out and make this stuff work. And I had 2 weeks to do it. Normally it would be like a year-long college class. And so people are, when they come to us, they're going to be ready to take on the information. We've got to be able to present it to them in a rational, systematic way at a rate of change that they can handle. You don't want to scare them off or think you're crazy or, you know, think that you're doing something illegal. That's the thing that we've got to overcome, is this sense of that we're somehow in the shadows, that we're outlaws and we're bad people because we're saying the truth. No, we've got to hold our heads high and say we stand for the truth. We stand for reality. We stand for exposing your lies. You're the ones that are lying. You're the ones that are deceiving. You're the mass murderers. We have nothing to be ashamed of. And that's another one of the big ones, is this guy who had the what was called the learned helplessness experiment. And, you know, just to how to break society's will and get them into a state of learned helplessness so they give up all will to live. And that's what we saw in the Soviet Union, where people would just lay down and die because they had been so broken. The same thing we see in this country is, you know, people are committing suicide left and right because they have just given up and think the situation is hopeless. And the situation is not hopeless by any means. We have just been presented a big paper tiger from the television media that they think is huge and unconquerable, when in reality it's a very minuscule part of the global population. I think it's very telling that the Israelis came up with a program called Megaphone, whereby anytime anybody said anything bad about Israel, they would send out an alert to flock all these Jews and, you know, Jewish supporters to that site to basically play whack-a-goyim on the person who dared say anything, and the person would be outnumbered. They would complain, get them banned, I know that happened to me at CNN. I was banned from CNN merely for talking about Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I was one of the early supporting members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I was merely stating the facts of 9/11, and I got the tribal treatment and got banned. And when I tried to appeal it, there was no appeal from CNN. It's like, you can't go back. And I'm just like, fine, but that was, the megaphone was such a symbol to me because they're trying to make themselves out to be bigger than they are. And they act all tough and intransigent and just this master class, supremacist ideology. But what's interesting now is, you see all these images coming out of Syria now that the Russians are there actually fighting them. And you see all these Israeli guys that are, supposedly, ISIS and everything, literally wetting their pants. I saw a great image today of all these Israeli IDF guys hunkered down, and every one of them had wet their pants. And it's like, that should go on every website on the planet, just to show what cowards these people really are. They will not fight a fair fight. They're bullies. They think that nobody's going to stand up to them for fear of being called an anti-Semite, et cetera, et cetera. And that's got to change. We've got to be we have had generations of programming to try to turn us into these emasculated steers and queers. We have got to get over that and, as people around here say, grow a pair and stand up to these people and back each other up. That's the key thing. You've got to have backup. And so in the Trading Post model, we'll talk about how, you always have your quest parties in a minimum of a group of three. And when I send a crew out, you have the point person, the backup, and what we call the gopher. And the gopher is the person, that runs and gets stuff or will stay behind for logistical support. And it's symbolized by an arrow where you have the arrowhead, the shaft, and the feathers. And that is, the symbol of a Trading Post work crew. And so, like I said, you have your point person, you've got your backup person, which is your staff, and that may be more than one person. Then you have the gopher, which is, a lot of times that's your logistic person that stays behind and maintains contact. For example, I had to go up last week to D.C., and it was one of my crew's brother was murdered in a suburb outside of D.C., and it was a case of black-on-white hate crime. And I was going up, and I was acting as the advocate, working with the police detective, working with the funeral home. I had to go in and clean up the murder scene and help the family get through this horrific event. And so I had, my crew all lined up, so that, I had my logistics person back here that was in real-time communication with me the whole time while we were going through this. And, it was a very scary situation because, it was occupied territory. It was one of those nice 70 suburbs for, basically white people to live in the suburbs of the 70s. And it had been turned into the black ghetto. And my brother was one of the holdouts who didn't want to sell out. That was his home. That was his and his wife's home. And she had died last year, and they basically just busted in and killed the guy. And so I had to go in and clean up that murder scene. And that was just, a real horrific, reality check of this is the reality on the ground. This is what's happening, and this needs to stop. And I had to be worried about, we're going to go in here, and there's nothing to say that while we're in here cleaning, they're not going to come back and kill us. So we've got to be prepared for that. And so I was in, had my backup person there, had my logistics person back here. We were in real-time communication the whole time, and, that was the way we played it. And so, we're going to be going into some very, very delicate situations, and hostile situations the more and more we get into this. And like I said, it is bad out there. I'm buffered here in the mountains, North Carolina, but, you know, in Africa right now, for example, and parts of North Carolina, like, you know, Wilmington and Charlotte are horrific right now in North Carolina. There's a lot of bad things happening there. And we have got to learn how to, you know, stand together and work together. And so I'm going to be presenting this model over the coming weeks. And hopefully, you know, there's going to be an interest in it, and that we're going to grow something here. And I think, you know, this has the best shot of succeeding of anything I've seen, because one of the things I see in the truth community is I see a lot of wonderful people working on one part of the puzzle. They're just focused on one part, but there's not a overlay to give direction to the movement. And so I see a lot of wasted energy out there and a lot of analysis, but not a lot of in reactionary mode and be in proactive mode. We've got to go on the offensive here, and we've got to have our strategies worked out. And one of the key things is, you know, to understand the game rules of this type of warfare. And like I said at the beginning of the show, we are at war, but it's a different type of war. And so when you look at fourth generation warfare, it's basically defined as being complex and long-term, use terrorism as a tactic. It's non-national or transnational. Our enemies, you know, they want to destroy nationalism. That's what they've always wanted, because they see that they own the planet and the only nation should be Greater Israel and everything else just a federation of that Greater Israel. A direct attack on the enemy's culture, because what you're trying to do is destroy a cultural identity and also genocide. So what we're seeing right now in notice you will not see any elderly. The elders aren't refugees. You won't see women with small children. You won't see small children. What you see is a bunch of military age men being dumped onto Europe and North America. Notice that South America is not getting any of these refugees. Africa is not getting any of these refugees. China is not getting any of these refugees. India is not getting any of these refugees. And Israel sure is not getting any of these refugees. They made a point that they're not taking any refugees. So you're looking at an invasion force designed for white genocide. They're trying to destroy white Western culture. They use highly sophisticated psychological warfare and media manipulation and lawfare. So our courts are corrupted, our media is corrupted. They are using psychological warfare against us. So one of the big things we're going to be working on is to train on what are these principal psychological warfare tactics. And you mentioned several of them. I call them the top 10 that we'll be training on about, you know, this is the trick. This is psychological warfare. This is how we, you know, I use the symbol of, you know, your body armor. You know, you got to have your armor on, and then you got to have your shield, and you got to have your sword. And that, you know, that shield of virtue and that sword of truth, you know, those aren't just cliches. Those are battle strategies. You've got to have that. And so one of the biggest things is you're going to arm yourself with the knowledge of the tactics your enemy is using against us. They're going to use all available pressures on us, both political, economic, social, and military. And that's one of the saddest things is due to the programming, you know, you're not going to be interfacing with the enemy directly. Your biggest problem is trying to get through the attacks from people you know and love that have been brainwashed by these people. What they have done to our young men, turn them against their parents, turn them against their culture, make them self-hating, that, and under the guise of being progressive, I hear that term all the time. I hear this I'm a liberal, I'm progressive, I want change. And that's just code word for self-hating, self-destruction. You know, you're trying to culturally destroy these individuals so that they, you know, have no identity. And that's key to fourth generation warfare. Using non-combatant as tactical dilemmas. One of the biggest problems is dealing with the Frankfurt School tactic of what's called critical theory. And critical theory is not critical thinking. It's basically how to undermine a belief system just by challenging it and belittling it. And we see this constantly in education where these children or these young people coming out of high school and university and college, et cetera, have been programmed to think everything about this constitutional republic, everything about Western civilization is bad and wrong and needs to change, and we need change. But they don't really think it through to see what that change is going to be if the Zionists get their way. And it basically means you're either going to be enslaved or dead. But they will sit there and defend that against you. And that is going to be the hard part, is going up against people in your immediate community, friends, family, church, et cetera, school, business, et cetera, that they've been programmed to see anybody who sticks up for white culture, anybody who sticks up for value systems, for honor, integrity, is their enemy. And I'm not your enemy. The people lying to you are your enemy, but you can't see it right now because of what's called Stockholm Syndrome. And this is such a bizarre concept, is, you know, they will defend the people that are actually abusing them and using them and leading them astray, yet they will defend them. That's called Stockholm Syndrome, based on when you have a kidnapped victim that suddenly starts identifying with the kidnapper and will actually defend them against the people trying to rescue them. So that's, we're going to talk about tactics around that. The other thing is, you know, asymmetrical warfare is there's a lack of hierarchy. At times you're going to feel like you're battling ghosts and shadows because there's not a clear target for us to focus on at the micro level. But when you start looking at the macro level, you can see what the end game is and who our enemies really are. Also looking at how they're using the small, compact fifth column networks. A lot of the kinds are, you know, 501c3 NGOs, non-government organizations, these not-for-profits. Anytime I hear not-for-profit, you know, civil organization, whatever, or charitable organization, et cetera, that's a red flag, because so many of those groups are nothing but fifth columns in communities to undermine the existing structure. Anytime I hear something like here at the University of Appalachian State University, there's a Holocaust Studies Peace and Tolerance division. They've got their home group over there that's always doing all these community outreach programs to brainwash people into the big lie of the Holocaust and about, you know, you got to have transgender rights, you got to have gay rights, you got to have this. And, you know, it's all about attacking the traditional culture up here by being all politically correct and, you know, dogma that they're promoting. And they're heavily funded. And what's funny is when I go to one of their events where they're, you know, talking about the Holocaust, et cetera, if I bring up anything that goes against their narrative, they take me aside and say, you either shut up or we're calling security and we'll have you arrested. And I'm sitting there going, this was open to the public. This was open to the community. I'm just asking a question. I'm bringing up facts that is tearing down your narrative. and you're playing basically whack-a-goyim, you know, because you do not believe in free speech. You are being a bully here, and you're, you know, you're basically a fifth column. This is not community education. This is brainwashing and conditioning. And a lot of times they're doing these programs where they're bringing in young teachers to train them on Holocaust education so that they can then go to the schools and, you know, basically repeat or parrot all these things they learned. And if then that illusion gets broken down. And so they will literally threaten to call security and have me arrested. And I'm like, go ahead. You know, we'll go on the paper. Yeah, I'm not scared of you. And they, it's always a fun dynamic to play with them. But these are the kind of things that we're going to have to start working out as we move from the keyboard out into the communities. It's, you know, what are the strategies of these, you know, NGO fifth columns? And then the other part is the reality of, you know, they're going to be using guerrilla tactics. These people are ruthless. They pride themselves on being ruthless. And, you know, we've got to be able to defend ourselves against that. And so these are just some of the highlights that, you know, we want to be covering in this class or this show and class. That's funny. You know, I hope you've enjoyed tonight. I totally enjoyed being with you. I once again thank Radio Werewolf for the opportunity. And like I said, this was just kind of, I wanted to introduce myself, introduce what I was wanting to do with the show. And like I said, next week, I will want to be bringing in some phone calls. I want to be able to have some guests on and just do some peer review analysis on my work, what I've done so far over the years, and also be, you know, wanting to try to help you set up similar type systems in your communities, your neighborhoods, your homes. A lot of you, you know, you're having a rough time right now, and believe me, I've been there. And, you know, to be able to act as a resource to, you know, help you get stabilized and oriented and, you know, moving in a good direction. And so that's the main points I wanted to bring up tonight. I know it's kind of covered a lot of territory. And I hope you all come back next week. And like I said, I'll be posting the link to the website when I get that up. And I hope everyone has a wonderful evening and a great week. And I'll talk to you next week. And until next time, I'll see you at the rendezvous.